recorded at Get a Grip Studios in Toronto, Canada, a Get a Grip Management production and in association with the Get a Grip on Lighting podcast. Financially supported by the good folks at the National Association of Innovative Lighting Distributors, this is Restoring Darkness podcast.
This episode of Restoring Darkness is brought to you by Evluma. If you're serious about contributing to the reduction of light pollution, go to evluma.com, hover over products, and click on Dark Sky Friendly Lighting. Both the OmniMax and ArriaMax lights are International Dark Sky Association certified. The warmer color temperatures of the OmniMax reduce the more easily scattered blue wavelengths, which contribute to glare and sky glow. With ArriaMax lights, you get full cutoff, which also means no uplight and a significantly reduced contribution to sky glow. And all of Evluma's outdoor lighting product lines come with dimmable drivers for even more control. If your customer is looking for dark sky friendly fixtures with energy savings while still meeting the demands of decorative lighting, look no further than Evluma. Evluma, illuminating the pursuit of dark skies.
Welcome back to the Restoring Darkness podcast. John and I today have the great pleasure of interviewing Camila Ratzik. She has a bachelor's degree in design culture and a master's degree in lighting design from Aalborg University in Denmark. She finished her degree in the summer of 2021 and has started working as a team manager in the museum in Copenhagen. She has a side hustle. She continues to work on lighting projects she started last year on her master's program. We're going to talk a little bit about that. This involves research within lighting and darkness and developing lighting on Anholt Island in collaboration with the association Dark Sky Anholt, which we're going to talk more about. Camila, welcome to the Restoring Darkness podcast.
Thank you so much. It's nice to be here.
It's nice to have you. What I want to know is, before we get into what you're actually doing on the island, how did the idea of light and darkness come about at the university? How did those two terms finally, that, you know, John and I have been hoping to bring together to the table, how did it come that you guys began speaking about light and darkness?
It actually began in the second semester of my master program, because we had to do outdoor lighting, and in my group we ended up working with darkness a lot, and I think it's maybe because we made a lighting design. We wanted to we had a case at the harbor of Copenhagen. And we read some different master plans. We have like a lighting master plan in Copenhagen, and it spoke a lot about darkness. And so we realized that it was actually important for our project to think about darkness when designing light. And so, we started to get into it and found out about light pollution. And for me, that was like, what's going on? Like, I never heard about it before, actually. So that was really a big turning point for me. And I think since then, actually, for me, it's less like I would not call myself a lighting designer. I would call myself like a darkness designer instead.
Baby, that's what.
That's
awesome.
It's more interesting because you sort of have to understand darkness as the, like, that's the frame, that's the main thing. And then you have to figure out what can we do with lighting in this space of darkness?
Mm-hmm.
So
you've said a lot of things there. Like, I love the term working with darkness, and I like the term darkness designer. I think that's such an interesting, we're trying to, you know, incorporate, you know, half the world is dark, you know, 50% of the of light is darkness, actually, it should be. And there's an offense to the darkness. We can offend the darkness. I mean, the other fellow we had almost talking about the public realm of darkness, you know, this idea of a realm. Tell me about working with darkness. What do you mean when you say that specifically as a lighting designer within a university master's degree program? What does that mean?
That's a difficult question, actually, because I sort of felt like I took something away from the lighting master program, because in a way it became secondary to the darkness, because I felt like it's more important for me to focus on darkness, and then light will be an add-on. And I want to stop it as much as possible. Like, I want it to be as limited as possible. So in a way, it's a bit not very nice to lighting to be this focused on darkness suddenly. So for that, like, I think I was the only one at my master program who actually really felt this deep about darkness. But I feel like I kept talking about it, and people started to see the importance of it, and that was really interesting, actually, for people to be like, wait a second, that's actually interesting, and that's really important for us, not just lighting, because you can easily just put up a lamp here and there and everywhere, it will look cool. We're very fascinated by light, like humans are.
I think it looks like crap. I'll be honest with you. I think most lighting is very poorly done, actually, outdoors. Yeah. But you're right. Most people are attracted to it, like moths to the flame. But you know,
lighting festivals are a big thing these days. So
I'm okay with a lighting festival as long as the festival ends. This idea of work. This is called the Restoring Darkness podcast, right? So what we're trying to do is allow the dark to seep back towards us, to come back to us. Mm-hmm. And you talked about people not understanding the importance of darkness. What is the importance of darkness, Camilla?
There are many important. There is, of course, the biological importance. Like, all living creatures need the natural rhythm of day and light, day and night. And we cannot live without it. We need it to live, both like trees and plants and different small animals, organisms, humans, and it can lead to a lot of diseases also for humans. And maybe we don't sleep well at night if we are all like constantly affected by light. And so that's one. And then second of all, and I think that's maybe what became really interesting for me in the field of lighting design, is that we also forgot the whole experience about darkness. Like, how is it to actually go outside and see the stars? Like, what's the atmosphere about that? And what's the importance about that? Because back in time, people used the stars to lead their way and to understand so many things. Like, it's actually a pretty big deal. And now we've lost this connection with the stars and with darkness. So we don't even, people don't even notice. Like, they in a way, they don't care. I even had friends saying, when I told them about this and about minimizing light, they say, but why? I mean, because you cannot see the stars. And they're like, I even heard that some kids think that the Milky Way is like Santa Claus, like that, you know, that it's something somebody made up. Like, it's like a fairy tale or something, sad. That it's not real. That's pretty sad to think about that. So for me as a lighting designer, I think that part was really interesting, to work with the whole atmosphere about a darkness and how we actually connect to it as humans.
It seems that the real shift here is that we've all, as I was growing into lighting, that darkness is just an absence. Darkness is something that isn't. It isn't light. Mm. It stops you from doing things. And what we need to do is to get rid of it. So everything that we do is seen through that lens of, I need to be able to understand and recognize what it is that I'm doing. Darkness will not allow me to do that, and therefore darkness is a problem. and it's only in the last
Is that a problem that needs to be solved or something? Yes.
And we've, Michael, we've talked about this time and again that you know this idea of it, because it's a problem to be solved, we have to get the legislators involved, we have to get the code writers involved, we have to get the standards writers involved, and it's all designed to take away this thing. But now we are talking about, it's not a symmetry. It's not like this. You can't say, well, dark is just another form of light, because it isn't. Dark is the platform upon which the light appears. But when all the power's gone and the candles go out, that's the natural state of the world for 50% of the time.
Yes.
And to turn that into a positive, theatre, the black box, theatre have done that since forever. Some of the most dramatic art shows that you'll go to will be black box shows. And you can feel that in some of those, the darkness is being used as a real positive medium within which this lumpy stuff that we call light can actually be embraced. But what I haven't seen, and I don't know how you do it, is how you embrace darkness. Because you can't focus darkness. You can't just go right in the middle of that room, boof, it's dark.
Yeah,
you can't do that.
You can't project darkness. You have to leave it untrammeled or something. You have to leave it untrammeled.
It's that whole thing. And I think, Camilla, with all the work that you're doing and the guys that you're talking to, I think this idea of, if we can't project it, if we can't say, I want to walk around that corner and I just want to enjoy dark, how do we do it? Because it needs to be done. And we need to find that way to be able to do that. And it's not just going to be like a ghost train on a fairground. No. You know, you're going in the dark and someone's going to scare you. That's just using dark as an absence again. Dark as a celebration. How do we get there? Tell me.
I actually think that, for example, if you imagine a dark room and you light up a candle in this room, you actually see darkness. Like, at least you can really sense it. With light, you actually sense the darkness. So with this little bit of light, it's not a lot, you actually get this incredible magical feeling. And that's also what I work with in my lighting design. To get that feeling of darkness with the tiniest bit of light. And there is, right now I don't remember this very nice quote by a guy called Tanisaki. I also don't remember the first name, but it's really nice. And he talks about how you see darkness with this candlelight, in a way, because it also makes shadows and it creates different levels of shades and darkness and light in this room of darkness. So that's what I believe, that if we, for example, the lighting design that I did, I imagined the, like, so little light on this church that I don't know how much. Did you read the article that
did? I was going to say I can see what you're trying to do there.
Yeah. So because I really you can talk.
Okay.
Great classic. You go.
You sure? Right. Yes. Right, I'm going. I feel that what you hit there was this idea that taking the moon as being the starting point, the natural moonlight. This is just talking about light in nature. I don't know that this is actually talking about light and dark. I think this is talking about, this is the world. This is the world as we experience it. And if the if we've got the joy of a full moon, and we've got a dark village, and we've got a church, and we've got moonbeams. It doesn't get better than that. And anything else that you try to do does not make it better. It makes it brighter. And at some point you trip into that, you know, this is human civilization getting in the way again. But with the design that you were looking at, with, you know, different ways of presenting that church depending upon what the natural circumstance was, never lifted, it seems, it never lifted the landscape out of the natural order of things.
It's true.
And that perhaps is what we're talking about.
Yes.
To you.
But there is still a bit of lighting in the, I still imagine a bit of lighting, a very warm light, and against the cold moonlight. That also brings, like, that's theories about colors, and also, like, then you like the cold moonlight will seem even colder with this warm light. So in a way, because you have this contrast, like, it enhances each other. And that's in mm-hmm. a way the same with light in darkness. Like, this little light actually made darkness visible in a new way, because if you step into the darkness in Anhalt, if there is no moon and it's clouded and there is no light, there is no light. You see nothing. Like, you will step into, like, trees and such. Like, you cannot see anything. So with this, imagine that you then turn on a little bit of, like, a candle and walk around with this. You will suddenly see, like, shadows and the bushes a bit here, and they will disappear again. You will continue walking, and you will sense the room in a new way. And I think darkness becomes visible in this, at this point, which I think is really interesting.
We've been celebrating rural darkness on this show because we sense that when we're away from the city, we have got more control. We can leave more darkness. It's probably the only place where people live and they will say, we don't want any street lighting. Will you turn that floodlight off? Because we're here for the darkness. And I think, you know, that is a fantastic, I mean, certainly in the UK, we will ignore what goes on in the country because they're just country people. It's only mm-hmm. the cities that matter. And one of the things that we've talked about, and I'd just be interested to hear from you in terms of where you think we might be able to make these inroads, where we've actually got that idea that darkness is working for us, and this idea that just that little shift that enables us to enter into the darkness, how we apply that into the city streets. And how we bring it to where all the people are.
Yes.
You know, the nice thing about the country is no one lives here, does it? Do they? I mean, it's, you know, there's one person, and another mile away, there's somebody else. But when you're actually living on top of people and you go, we want to be able to create that magic. And who's going to be brave enough to be able to incorporate that kind of darkness into an urban condition?
I think actually in Denmark, there is a lot of good examples of this also, because in Copenhagen in general, it's like a really dark city actually.
Yeah.
Compared to other cities around the world. And I think, of course, you cannot take my design one-to-one and say, okay, we're going to do this at the City Hall Square or something like that. But then the overall point is I think we need a law saying how much you actually want. Like, we need a light pollution, minimizing light pollution law or something like that. And so everybody needs to lower the lighting, because if we lower the lighting, then it's a great way to start, because then we can start adjusting a bit and figuring out, like, on the big roads, like, what about the streets, what about the parks? Like, we need to work with lighting in a way on a bigger level, and to agree that we all need to turn it down. Because the issue is that, let's say that you're going on the highway, you see one gas station with a lot of light, the gas station on the other side will look super gloomy and super dark. Mm-hmm. And he thinks, okay, I also want a lot of light because I want customers, so I'm gonna take up the lighting mm-hmm. a notch. And then suddenly the one that before was super bright now looks super mm-hmm. gloomy and dark. So this is also what happens in the city. It just, like, goes like this. Mm-hmm. With LED lighting, there is, like, no limits you buy one lamp and it light up the whole street. So I think if there was some sort of regulations also how to cover the light, like the amateurs, how do they actually look? How do they cut off the lighting so that it doesn't shine in 100 directions? Mm-hmm. I think we can do a lot by doing that. And then afterwards, we can do all the fun stuff to actually design something with darkness, because then you will maybe start to experience some darkness in the city.
John, do you mind if I jump in here? Because I'm chomping at the bit here. So I think this is the issue of the century for the lighting industry. I think it's going to take a long time to fix this problem, unfortunately. And, you know, I'm hoping to see, you know, results in my lifetime. But, you know, who knows? I was listening to you and John kind of riff together there and interrupt each other, but riff along on a couple different things. And what emerged to what you were saying was that there's a power in, I don't know if this is the right way to put it, but coming up with the scarcity of light, or getting the correct amount of light, and that scarcity of it, or the minimization of it, actually presents darkness to you. Without, like, it's a presenter of the darkness, and this idea of a separation in color temperature, so a firelight, candlelight, in contrast to the moon, which I believe is 4,100 Kelvin or something like that. That contrast is powerful, and this idea of darkness becoming visible, John. And I think that that is interesting, because we want, you know, but I've never heard that idea, like making darkness visible, using minimal light sources and warm color temperatures as a way to gain access to the darkness. My question to you is, and my comment actually that I want you to, you're talking about Javon's paradox, which is that as something becomes cheaper, the more of it we use, and we ratchet up against one another. How do we, like, your beautiful lighting design that you created is going to be completely dismantled and destroyed by something like that? It can't be appreciated at all. How do we recognize that? Like, you talk about regulations. What's the first, I mean, both of you, John, like, what's the first step here? Is it industry alignment? Is it regulations? Where do we start?
Camilla, let's start with the boring. Yeah. Shall I do the boring thing?
Go do the boring part first, John.
Yeah, because I don't know.
Another document I was reading today has come from the Institution of Lighting Professionals, from the ILP, in the UK. And of course, this is the document. These are the people who wrote the document on obtrusive light and lighting for bats and small mammals. And because we've got an energy crisis, and because we've got a cost of living crisis, they've come out with a guidance document for reducing outdoor lighting. And I thought, oh, this is going to be exciting, because they've never gone to this place before. Well, sadly, they haven't gone to this place this time either. So all that they've got is to say, if you are, I don't know how to put this. If in your high street you are meant to have a sort of grade A lighting scheme, well, if you can justify having a grade B lighting scheme or a grade C lighting scheme, then that will naturally reduce your costs. But they are always working within the legal framework that says, if you provide lighting, you need to defend yourself against anyone who's going to sue you because they tripped over something that they couldn't see on the pavement. And until we move on from that place, we are lost, because, you know, we've said we're not obliged to put in street lighting, but if you do put in street lighting, you have to make sure that it's correct. And so constantly we are talking about a level of light that we don't need. And you write about the misperception of how bright moonlight is. And so we have standards that are built around moonlight, except the moonlight figures that people are coming up with are 10 times brighter than what moonlight actually is.
Mm.
So we've got all the standards wrong. We've got all the approaches wrong. We've got this condition where everyone says, well, we've got to have light, we've got to have light. No one of any in any authority will say, no, we don't. Unless, of course, you live in the country where, you know, and we happily wander around in complete darkness all the time because we carry torches and they, you know, they will do the thing for us. But creatively, Camilla, what, you know, who are you talking to who is actually saying, I like what you're talking about. That's where we want to go. That's the exciting part of what of how we want to deal with our nighttime environment. Are you talking to any people who we'd say they're champions of this?
Yes, I feel like I've only met people who said it was great. I mean, I think people really love the idea, but I think we all end at this discussion where we are now. How do we get there in a city? So that's the tough part, because people are like, but it's not realistic. It's like, it cannot happen. We cannot do this. It's such a nice idea, but yeah, good job trying to make this happen. Mm-hmm. And that's difficult also because a lot of people have this idea that more lighting equals more safe environments. I mean, thieves and people who wants to commit a crime, they also need light. Like, it's not like they go around in complete darkness. So I don't see this as an argument. I think we're in a way lazy and we're just scared of our own imagination, because that's what we see when we go around in darkness. We project all our inner fears and how we feel, and that's what we're scared about, because Denmark is also such a little safe place, so maybe a lot of people will disagree with me, but I haven't seen any research yet that shows, you know, that less lighting means more criminal things happening. So that, it's difficult. It's also in a way in our culture to hate darkness, like the dark force. Like, there is so much bad stuff about darkness, and it's been like that since way back. So in a way, we just build up this idea about darkness as a bad thing. So now we need to change. And I think a podcast like this and things that I do and other people that I meet, International Dark Sky Association, all these, I think these big organizations, I think people start talking about this now. And I think we just need to continue talking about this to change how we perceive it in a way, because I think that's cultural. And then of course there is a lot about the regulations that we need to take a serious look at as well. So I only hear people being so positive about it, but it's so unrealistic in a way.
That's the strange thing, isn't it? When people witness it, they go, this is amazing. Mm-hmm. We need to have more of this. Yes. But then as soon as you turn around, you go, well, who's going to give us more? No one, because everyone's scared to do it. What are we scared of? We're scared of our own shadows.
Yeah.
So we are scared. You know, that, I mean, the whole sort of Jungian side, you know, that we are scared of our own darkness. We are scared of the thing that the darkness that we project. We can project darkness. It's called a shadow. One of the greatest movies ever made was The Third Man, and you know, and the fantastic light and shade in that movie, and of course that you know, Nosferatu, you know, that shadow in on the wall of the vampire. The shadow gets a bad press all the time. And yet, it's a wonderful, you know, I've said before, and I'm going to say it again. I've stood in my own Venus shadow. There was no moon, but Venus was up in the sky, and it was a clear sky, and I could see my shadow that came from Venus. And you think, just think what that means. And it is such an spiritually uplifting experience to understand how light and dark are working together. And you only get that from darkness. You cannot flood places with light and expect to get that kind of subtlety. I'm not going to keep ranting, Michael. I think you've probably, you're sort of sitting there going, when's he going to shut up?
Well, I'm very interested in this this comment, this laziness comment that I think is interesting. Yeah. I think that's really interesting that we're lazy, you said, Camilla, and scared of our own imaginations. I think that's very much true as well. And I often compare it to the, I don't know if you've done any work with lighting controls or occupancy controls in buildings, but I've often, you know, we do a lot of parking garages, for example, where we've done lighting controls in them. And the often thing is, well, what if there's a thief or a crook hiding in the darkness? Well, the sensors see the crook too, actually. You understand what, like, this is some of the perceptions we have about these technologies. You know, if someone's a crook and they move, it also turns on the lights. Like, they're not immune to the passive infrared rays of the technology or whatever. And so a lot of times we are lazy. And our axiomatic presupposition starts off with Christ as the light of the world, and that bringing light into the darkness is a good thing. And I don't care whether you profess yourself to be a Christian or not in 2023. The point being is that is the cultural heritage of Europe, is this idea that, you know, European enlightenment, removing the darkness, yeah, is so deep in our culture, okay, that it needs to be consciously expunged. And I don't mean that we want to get rid of our culture or our history, but we're just talking about the metaphor needs to be gotten rid of. This metaphor that dark as bad and light as good, as deep as heaven and hell and our spirituality and what happens after we die. Like, this is so deep in ourselves. That's axiomatic presupposition that more light is more, is healthier, better, good, safer, everything, philosophically, enhancement of our brains. Like, we named the Enlightenment. Like, think about that. We named the greatest philosophical movement in the history of the world, or whatever, in the history of the Western world, maybe, the Enlightenment. Now, how could we not have a problem with light pollution after that?
Yeah, and of course, when the Romans left the UK back in whenever it was, they heralded the Dark Ages.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, so yes, there is that incredible negative. I'll put my hand up. I think I might have designed car park lighting for the darkest car park in England. It was in a very historic city. It was in the basement of a shopping center, and the architect wanted it to be like a crypt. Okay, fine. So let's make sure there is some light where you can actually put, sure, you can put stuff in, put your shopping into the trunk of the car, and that's fine. But the place was dark, and the place terrified people to the point they wouldn't use it. And it's one of those things, yeah, it's an absolute sort of vox pop experience. They say,
yes, sure,
rubbish. And you go, it looks fantastic.
Listen.
It looks scary.
In the lighting design world, I think you can go very low with light levels if they're uniform. So in a parking garage, if you have huge contrasts in light in a parking garage with a low ceiling and the posts and pillars and big shadows, if there's a lot of contrast, even if the average is higher, if the uniformity is lower, I feel like it doesn't look as nice. If you have I'm going to speak in foot candles, but if you have an average of 5 foot candles, okay, and I don't know what that is, 50 lux, say, five-foot candles or whatever, to 55 lux or whatever, and that's the average throughout the entire garage, and the fluctuation is 2 or 3 foot candles. So in the corner, there's one and then two, and then, but the, you know, the average is 5 and maybe 10 below the light fixture. People will report very good sight. And if you even dim it too, you can play with dimming in parking garages. Mm-hmm. But as long as you maintain the uniformity, I find that people, the light level is not that important. It's more about the evenness in those kinds of spaces, which is the opposite for dark skies outside. You don't want that uniformity. We want to keep the light where we need it. But yes, go ahead, John.
We've got Steve Fotios at the University of Sheffield who's saying exactly that about street lighting, that it's all about uniformity. And then you get people like me who will go, But uniformity is the most boring thing that we can possibly do.
It is.
Because it has no flavor.
It
has no highlights and lowlights.
In the outdoor environment where there, but John, in the outdoor environment in Camille, in the outdoor, where there's no walls, where does the uniformity end outside then? Yeah. You know what I mean? You could potentially, does it go keyhole to keyhole like Chicago, South Chicago is, which is one of the most dangerous urban environments in the world? You know, where all the streets are lit up keyhole to keyhole? It doesn't provide more safety there. Let's bring it back to Camila, though. You've been saying for a long time, and John and I have been arguing, but yes.
Yeah, but I just think there's something right about this uniformity. It's boring, yes, but it also, I think, if we just try to make to be more uniform with lighting, or that we agree on the light levels, again, we want the darkness, so you don't want completely uniform lighting all over the place. But I think we could lower the light levels if we do that, and if everybody does that, then we will have like a nice balance between light and darkness. That's what, like, I'm pretty sure about that. I've been working actually with a woman called Mette Vess. She's a researcher at the university, and she's been guiding me through this, the master thesis and everything. And she's made a PhD about balancing light levels. So of course that's also different from uniformity, but still, I think balancing is the nice keyword here to see, okay, I'm here in a station, and if I have so much lighting on me right here on this station, I will feel trapped inside this lighting, and it will seem completely dark.
Yes,
right outside, because I will be inside the light. Yeah, exactly, inside the lighting. And there will be an outside of the lighting, but if we lower the light level so it fits better with the, let's say, the street lighting or something on the other side, then I would feel more in the same place in a way. So the light
I thought you had it right when you said working with darkness. I thought that was a better, I thought that was the right starting point, is this idea of darkness design. Designing darkness into it. And I think we keep defaulting back to this intervention, to the intervention, you know. And I think the public realm, John, that what's his name,
Karim,
that with the public realm, the darkness realm, and that we're, you know, this idea, and that how we work with that. The other thing is that the idea of contrast is very dangerous when it comes to light, because it works both ways. Like what you were saying, there's a reason why when a police officer pulls you over in your car at night and walks up to your car, he shines shines a very bright flashlight into your eyes, and then you can't see them, but they can see you very, very clearly. That's a power move, right? You're using light as to create a power dynamic between two people. It's the same when you're having a party in your house at night and someone walks by and can see everything going on in the window, but they can't see you watching them. So we have to be careful with how we use these contrasts. But I like the working with darkness, John, and we're coming up on 40 minutes here. Any final questions?
Can I say something at the end here?
Absolutely.
Yeah, of course you can. Yeah.
I think there is maybe a little task for everyone out there. I think, because I did that when I started working actually with the darkness, to go outside and go through some of the dark places and the bright places, and then think about what is it that makes me uncomfortable, how do I feel in these different spaces, and don't be afraid of what you can actually learn about yourself as you go through this, because I've been scared as well in darkness, but I kept pushing myself to go through it and to do it, and now I enjoy it so much, I could go any place in darkness now. Again, I'm speaking about Denmark, and I know that if I'm in a different country, I also have to be aware of like, where am I? But I think it's really interesting. And I think we could all learn a lot from actually step out into the darkness and see what happens. Go down that path that you go during the day, but you don't go there at night because it's a bit scary because it's dark and you only have a few street lights. Just do it anyway. See what happens.
Yes, I agree. I think that's absolutely interesting. I think as well we need to take this is sort of following on from the Kerem's work that he's doing in the rural landscape. We must take the opportunities, as many as we can, to experiment and to just try and do these things. One of the things that came to me over the Christmas holidays, I was talking to some friends who live in one of the villages close to where I live, and there is no street lighting there. And I'm also talking to a manufacturer who wants to know what the next big thing is in exterior lighting. Well, the next best thing, because this is what I'm going to be talking to them about, is to go to tiny little villages in the middle of the countryside with a van full of small light fittings and work out how few you need to enable someone to walk from one end of the village to the other without carrying that torch, but also without lighting the place.
I have some ideas about that, but also, John, I would also say not just the manufacturers, but let's bring in the lighting controls people so that we can play with that level street by street, you know what I mean? And compare and contrast and see what we can create. I think it's a huge, like, the lighting controls people are missing the boat when they're trying to find the business case for lighting controls inside. I think it's totally in the urban public realm of darkness. I think that's where we can really do some magic, if Camilla had a control over the light level and the color temperature and can tune it to 2200 Kelvin, 1900 Kelvin, and then lower that light level down, and maybe even get to the point where you have mechanical shading, where you can shade the sides of the light fixture and change it, and then see people's perceptions. Do they feel less safe? Does it feel more romantic? Does it feel better? I mean, what you're talking about with the imagination is people are using their imaginations to imagine the worst case outcome of darkness. And I think we can, with lighting controls, we can create environments where people will imagine the beauty of darkness. And as you said, how darkness is shown to them with less light, by making the light a little more scarce, by making it a little more warm, we actually highlight the darkness in a way. And I love that. I love that about what you're talking about, Camilla. So that's now nice. It's time for your final thoughts, because you get the last word.
Oh, wow. That's interesting. No, actually, I just think that we can learn a lot from these people living in darkness, with darkness, for example, in Anhalt, because they know things that we don't. I learned a lot from them, and they are connected to nature in a different way. And I think we all need to realize that within yourself, go out and feel this on your own body. I mean, that's, I think we can only change if we start changing how we think about this darkness. So, yeah, it's interesting. And then we didn't talk a lot about how to then use moonlight in a design, because that's...
I know. Well, you know what? We can go... We have the average amount. If you'd like to... John, I don't know if you're... We want to be about 40 minutes, but there's nothing wrong with going a little bit longer.
Okay.
And I think that's fascinating. Go ahead and jump right into it.
I'm intrigued with the moonlight, because the thing about the moon that across its 28-day cycle, we know that we don't get a lot of it. We get bits of it, and then we'll get weather, and then we lose it altogether. So it is such... the moon is a harsh mistress, as the song goes. You do not know where he's going to be there. And we've had fantastic moonlight this week. Absolutely wonderful moonlight. And you just want to get down on your knees and just soak it in, because it's fantastic. But turning it into a design tool, explain to me how we do that.
So actually, the idea came from the people on Anhalt themselves, because they explained to me that they see bright nights, semi-bright nights, and dark nights. And I thought that was a beautiful way to describe it. Sometimes you just don't need lighting in a dark place like Anhalt. You just don't need electrical lighting because you have the moon that shines. Actually, of course, it's sunlight reflected off the moon's surface, if we want to be very precise about that. So then other nights, and they say that most nights are actually semi-bright. So there must still be some light going around reflecting in the clouds, or I actually don't know, but there is actually quite a lot of nights where they sort of see well, like you can still see contours and you can navigate more or less in the space. But then there are the incredible dark nights where it's completely dark and you don't see anything. And I thought that was so interesting. So I thought, okay, can we actually use this natural light in a lighting design? So why would I light up a place if the moonlight is enough lighting in a place? That's what I ask myself. So that's where I thought, okay, maybe if the moon is there, then we can shut off some of the lights that I'm imagining for the place when it's completely dark. And some people might think out there now, but why do you light up this place at all if it's a dark sky place and if people like the darkness? But we have to understand that we're in Denmark. It's dark at like sometimes 3 in the winter for many months, and you don't see any daylight until 9 in the morning. So imagine that you actually have a day that's only 6 hour long. You live in this place, Anhalt. You need something to shape the life that you're living here. You're going to school, you're going to work, you're meeting with the people around in the city. So we still needed some sort of atmosphere in this place because we all know how nice it is with light. So that's where I thought, okay, but they like darkness. They also want light. How can we merge these two things together? And so that's why I thought that I could shape the design around the moonlight to only light up when people need light.
So I'm not a designer. I'm not a designer, mm-hmm. and so most of my colleagues are lighting distributors like myself. But John, I've never heard of that before. Have you? In your career?
No. I mean, there are versions of it, but not in the way that Camilla's talking about here. Lighting controls, tying in a lighting installation to something that's happening in nature. Yeah, we do that. I live near the coast, and there are lighting installations in seafront towns, which are based upon the tide, as to whether the tide is in or the tide has gone out. And it's just trickery. But what we're talking about here, I think what we're talking about here is that we know exactly what the moon is doing. We may not be able to see it because we can't control the clouds, but we know that across that 28-day cycle that the moon is either at its fullest or it's at its darkest, or it's, and you can design an artificial, and this is Michael, without controls this means nothing, but you can determine what you see depending upon what the moon is doing, even if you can't see the moon. And if the moon comes out, it's a bonus. But it's that different. It's understanding that a full moon and a new moon are not the same thing. It's not just all of a sudden the moon's gone dark, you know. Moon madness and all of those things, all these things exist. The full moon is a different beast to a new moon. And so as we go through that, and the moon is probably more important to us spiritually than the sun has ever been. But we don't work with it. And so here's
moon,
an opportunity.
The moon grabs all of the water in the world and pulls it in one direction and then lets it go. It's
including,
like a giant. Yeah.
Including the water that's in us. Yeah,
I love the
moon.
I have a love affair with her. The moon is very feminine, actually. I hate to say that. I'm going to get some bad email here. But the moon, there's something feminine about the moon. I'm in love with
someone's going to argue with you?
I don't know. Good heavens. I love
her. Of course
the
moon is feminine.
The
moon's a... Yes.
I love the moon. I love that we can design. Like, I wonder to myself, like, the moon is so much less predictable than the sun is. So, because of, like, whether there's clouds or not, the sun comes up and there's light. Like, there's no block in the sun. I mean, you can, it's brighter days or whatever. So if you just have a photocell on the corner of a building and you're lazy, like you said, you put a little photocell. If it comes on 5 minutes later because it's cloudy, the lights go off or whatever at 5 minutes later than they should, and then they come on maybe a little bit later because the photocell's pointed at the sunset, so it gets a little bit more. You should have positioned it on the other side of the building, but it works. Are you? Do you have photocells for moonlight, Camilla? Is that what's going on there? How
there
are you guys
is...
doing this?
Well,
you don't know where that moon's going to be in the sky. How do
yes,
you position?
Yes, actually, you
that?
Are. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You
yeah,
do.
Yeah.
Okay.
The moon. Yes. The moon is That's also why it is actually very predictable, because the moon is exactly at the same place at the same time, like every month, every year.
Every month.
No, I mean month. Like then it changes, but you can actually. It looks like that. You wanna.
Yeah, but it's on something like a 19-year cycle.
Yeah.
It's okay. Quite. It's, I mean,
yeah. Okay, hang on. Yeah, is that according? Is that according to flat Earth theory or round Earth theory? No, I'm just joking, of course. But I'm just joking.
Yeah,
I'm just joking.
On a certain day, it will be. You can set your compass by it, but you don't necessarily know where what the elevation is going to be.
So how do you? How you have this built into your lighting design, Camilla?
Yes, I have. Wow. Like I have made. I haven't done calculations, but I have gathered all the information I could about the elevation of the moon and the brightness level and the like what time, like where is it at what time, and that you can predict. It is because it goes like it continues.
Now, what do
like
we
that.
Do about the clouds? What are you doing about the cloudiness? Are you just saying we just got to live with it? Or how you handle it? Are you got to connect it to a weather station that knows whether there's clouds or not? How are you dealing with that?
I will not say too much because there is some stuff going on that I don't think I can speak
intellectual
about
property wise? You mean intellectual property?
Yeah. I think so, but of course, like there, it's no secret that of course I know that we need we need to find out what do we do with days where it's completely clouded. Mm. Again, we're in Denmark; it's clouded most of the year, so that's a fact. Like we need to we need to figure out what to do. I don't have the answer right now, and I will. Stop it there because there is some things going on right now that that will make us come closer to figuring these things out.
So you're saying that there's brilliant. Possibly commercially valuable inventions or knowledge that you guys have created along this research that the industry should know more about, but not yet.
Yes.
Okay. Say nothing, Camilla. Say nothing.
That's so awesome. Okay. Yeah. Camilla, I'm glad we did this at the end here. I don't like your coyness about your secrets about the clouds, but we're going to get you back on the show hopefully sometime soon when that you're able to talk more about that. John, I am absolutely fascinated with Camilla's work. Is there any final thoughts from John to Camilla before we cut out?
No, I think the important thing here is that it's almost as if we've spent years and years and years ignoring all of this. Mm. There's the moon up in the sky and you go, oh, this is wonderful. Yeah, but to what extent do you celebrate it? And you go, what, in my work? I've never celebrated it in my work. Well, maybe now's the time to start thinking about what you can do with it because of, you know, the magic that's in the moon. And that's what's been great about this session. Camilla, thank you very much. It's been fantastic.
You're welcome.
And folks, if you made it to the end here, Camilla's on Instagram. Camilla Ratzak. I'm going to spell the last name. CamillaRatsach. And then if you look up Camilla Monberg, Monberg, Oh, I forgot the H in her name on the Instagram, by the way. It's
R-A-T-H-S-A-C-H.
Sorry about that. And then darkskyanholt.dk. That's where you can find her work. And if you've made it to the end, we don't have listeners or fans or anything like that. We only have colleagues in this business, whether they're dark sky advocates or lighting designers or distributors like me, that don't do podcasts. And we'd love it if you contacted us and wanted to come on the show. You're all welcome. Thanks for listening. Bye for now.
Look no further for dark sky friendly products than Evluma. Since its first product launch, Evluma has carried one or more International Dark Sky Association certified models. If your customer cares about light pollution, suggest the OmniMax with shielding or the ArriaMax with full cutoff to reduce uplight and glare. Evluma, illuminating the pursuit of darkness.